see so many of you here this morning. And having grown up in Northeast Washington and living in Northern Idaho, I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to share a couple redneck jokes. You have to be pretty careful when you pick these out, because they can range from acceptable to non-acceptable real quick. So hopefully I don't offend anybody in this process. But anyway, you might be a redneck if your kids take a siphon hose to show and tell. Or, and I like this one, and I think I can make it somewhat personal. You might be a redneck if you had to remove a toothpick from your wedding pictures. Now, I don't remember whether I had to do that or not, because it's been a number of years ago, but I could change that to something along the line that you might be a redneck if you had to remove the toothpick before you preached. But it's in my pocket, not far away. And I thought, in light of the price of gas, this is probably pretty good. You might be a redneck if the blue book value of your truck goes up and down depending on how much gas it has in it. Or you might be a redneck if you think the stock market has a fence around it. Or you might be a redneck if you stare at an orange juice container because it says concentrate. And I could probably kind of personalize that a little bit too, because you might be a redneck if you stare at the preacher and concentrate, because hopefully you may not stare at me this morning, but I do hope you concentrate. If you don't, I won't know, because with the lights as they are up here, it kind of, and I shouldn't say this because of future implications, but the preacher really can't see too many of you anyway, so we won't know whether you are sleeping or concentrating or whatever. But anyway, to a more spiritual nature, I'd like to begin by reading a paragraph from the book Unchristian, and a number of you have read it. I've read it a few times. I don't like it. It's not my favorite book, but I think it's a good book in that it should alert us to some issues related to our lives as Christians. And the paragraph I want to read says, in a study released in 2007, we found that most of the lifestyle activities of born-again Christians were statistically equivalent to those of non-born-again Christians. That is, well, let me continue reading. When asked to identify their activities over the last 30 days, born-again believers were just as likely to bet or gamble, to visit a pornographic website, to take something that did not belong to them, to consult a medium or psychic, to physically fight or abuse someone, to have consumed enough alcohol to be considered legally drunk, to have used an illegal non-prescription drug, to have said something to someone that was not true, to have gotten back at someone for something he or she did, and to have said mean things behind another person's back. Now, we live in a very isolated Christian community here at Living Faith Fellowship, and so I think we have maybe a different perspective, or at least we don't catch the significance of this, but that paragraph concerns me a great deal. I don't like it, and I think I have difficulty with it. I realize that doing these kinds of things and Christians doing sinful things is not something that is new, but I think this data would show that it is perhaps even increasing in terms of the frequency with which Christians and non-Christians are doing the same kinds of things. And I hear about it periodically, and sometimes it's fairly close to home. Otherwise, you read it here and you wonder, how can that be? What's going on? You know, and I recently read another book that kind of maybe helped me at least make some sense of this. And it was a book entitled Unconditional, The Call of Jesus to Radical Forgiveness. And I know a few of you at least have read that. And in that book, he argues that the church has tried to understand Jesus apart from the Sermon on the Mount. Or you could say the writings of Jesus in general, but the Sermon on the Mount is the most significant writing of Jesus. He argues that it would be like trying to understand Luther without knowing about the 95 Theses, or Martin Luther King without tying him to the I Have a Dream speech. It's kind of like, well, we're trying to understand Jesus, and yet we quite often ignore the Sermon on the Mount. So when he said that, I started reading the Sermon on the Mount again, and I read it a number of times. And we've all read it a number of times. It's part of our Bible reading. But in that, as I read that sermon, and I think as we all read that sermon, we kind of say, did he really say that? Is that really what Jesus said? But I don't see how I can do what Jesus said that we should be able to do. You know, there are almost 24 topics that Jesus deals with in the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, if you could just live the Sermon on the Mount, your life would be dramatically changed. Mine would. And that's in Matthew 5 to 7. And he starts out with the Beatitudes. He then talks about salt and light, the fulfillment of the law, murder and anger, adultery and lust, divorce, oaths, an eye for an eye, love for your enemies, giving to the needy, and the model prayer that we all know by heart. Give us this day our daily bread, etc. Fasting, treasures in heaven, the relationship between God and mammon. Don't worry, a whole section in there on not worrying. How many of us don't worry about something? Judging others, taking the beam out of your own eye before you take the toothpick out of someone else's. Ask, seek, knock, the narrow and the wide gates, the tree and its fruit, and the wise and foolish builder. And you might break those out a little bit differently if you read it, because it's kind of hard to separate it in spots. And yet, the Sermon on the Mount doesn't even cover all the teachings of Jesus. But can you begin to imagine with 24 of these topics what your life would be like if you just lived based on the Sermon on the Mount? It would be quite different. As I was mentioning this to Phil Waite earlier just before the service, and he made the comment that, well, how come we have the Ten Commandments in front of all of our courthouses, but the Beatitudes are not? I was sharing how we, as an evangelical church, tend to kind of ignore the Sermon on the Mount to a great extent. And the Beatitudes, just the first 7 or 8 verses in the Sermon on the Mount, talk about who's happy. Who are the happy ones? It says, blessed is, if you're a King James adherent. But it basically is talking about, if you want to be happy, you need to be merciful, you need to be humble, you need to be people who mourn or are concerned about issues. Those who pursue righteousness, those who are peacemakers, those who are pure in heart, and those who suffer persecution for doing good. What if the Beatitudes were in the front of our courthouses instead of the Ten Commandments? It would present quite a different message of what Christianity is all about. The Beatitudes basically undermine much of what we consider valuable in our culture. The whole system of basing happiness on lust and pride, on the pursuit of money and sex and power, the Beatitudes challenge every single one of those ideas. We all talk about the American dream, and at one time the American dream meant, oh, I want a piece of land and that I can call my own, a house to cover myself, and that's what the American dream is all about. But now it's become much more than that. It's how much can I get and what do I have to do to get it, and it doesn't really matter if I the most important thing is that I be happy and that I be satisfied, and whatever it takes to get that is kind of what the American dream has become over the years. The Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, if we go beyond that, challenges the whole system that we see as important in America. The Beatitudes are a threat to the rule of Satan, and he is the one who is governing kind of the nature of what goes on in the world. Living the Beatitudes is totally subversive to that kind of behavior. The Sermon on the Mount is both simple and complex. It is very simple to understand, but it is very complex to put into practice. It's not an easy thing. If it were as easy to do as it is to read about, we'd all be doing it. And we wouldn't be ignoring it, as we tend to have. But it doesn't really very easily fit into our mentality of how to get to heaven when I die. You know, we talk about the four spiritual laws, and we talk about the Roman road to salvation, and where does the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount fit into that kind of mentality of how do I get to heaven when I die? Well, you accept the Lord as your personal Savior. Well, the Beatitudes go way, way, way beyond that. Sermon on the Mount goes way, way, way beyond that. Mark Twain was once asked if he found the Bible hard to understand. Twain responded by saying that he wasn't bothered by the parts of the Bible he couldn't understand as much as he was bothered by the parts that he could understand. And I know I found that true myself. I have always said that my challenge is to live what I know is in the Bible and what I understand is in the Bible and not worry about the rest, because that's a big enough challenge as it is. So I have some observations on the Sermon on the Mount that I kind of got by reading over it a number of times here in the last month or so that I'd like to share. The first one is the Sermon on the Mount is a teaching on restoration. There is no reference in the Sermon on the Mount on how to get to heaven when you die. Nothing in there on it. It deals with how we live now. It deals with restoration. And we have these nice categories, you know, justification, sanctification, glorification, and that we move through them. The Sermon on the Mount, and I'm not even sure, you can think about this yourselves a little bit, whether you would make restoration the same as sanctification. The more I think about it, the more I even question that, because in the notion I have of sanctification is that it's to make me more holy. It's to separate me more from sin. And that's what I think of when I think of sanctification. Restoration, I think, deals more with God wants to restore us to our pre-sin nature. Now, we know that that's not going to, we know that we're far from that. But restoring has an idea of bringing it back and making it something that we do on an ongoing kind of basis. And I think that's what the Sermon on the Mount deals with. When you begin at Bethlehem rather than Calvary, you incorporate the Sermon on the Mount into the saving work of Jesus. A lot of times we focus on Calvary, and I don't negate that in any way, but we many times ignore everything that happened before Calvary. If we start at the beginning and look at the life of Jesus, and the Sermon on the Mount is definitely a significant portion of that, it's about living. It's about living as Christ would want us to. Did he really say, forgive, be merciful, love your enemy, turn the other cheek, and on and on and on? You can read through there. Did he really say those things and expect us to do something like that? You know, it's somehow so foreign to us to think that all of these things are things that he wants us to do. And we have such a difficult time doing them. Jesus shows us here that the road to restoration is a radical road. It is not an easy road. It's a radical road. It's different than the world. How many people in the world are going to tell you to forgive, to be merciful, to love our enemies, to treat those who harm you in love as he would do? Not too many. Jesus was not just born to die, he was born to live. To live fully and freely, to live as no human has ever lived, and he was born to show humanity God's intention for how we should live on the earth. Restoration, to show what his intention is for us. He came to be the way, to be the truth, and to be fully human. The problem with Christians who live like the world is that they have no motivation for restoration. They think they only need Jesus as a ticket to heaven. And when I read that paragraph earlier, as I read earlier, what other conclusion can you come to? That, hey, it wasn't the idea that I get saved and my life is radically changed. It's I get saved so I can go to heaven, and I'm going to live like everybody else in the meantime. Sermon on the Mount does not teach us that. The next observation would be that the Sermon on the Mount moves living from external rules to internal motivations. You know, they had all the rules beforehand. The Pharisees and the Sadducees had every jot and tittle down. And if you wanted to live by the rules and you followed them, then that was what there was to it. But when Jesus came, he changed the criteria totally. Moved it from outside rules to internal motivations. Matthew 5:17, do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And that's the interesting thing about the Sermon on the Mount. It says it also down here in 5:20, I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So if you wanted to keep the Old Testament rules, if you wanted to keep all of those rules and regulations, which the Pharisees and the Sadducees were doing, then that's fine, but in my kingdom, it's not going to be enough. In my kingdom, you can live just like they did, and you can do all of those things right. You can follow the Ten Commandments and do them all right. But in my kingdom, there's a different standard. And if we go back and read that, why, we can pick up that standard pretty quick, because he talks about, you know, don't no longer murder someone. Even if you're angry with them, you're sinning. That even if you, it's not just adultery, it's even if you look at someone of the opposite sex with lust in your eyes, that's sin. That's a whole different set of rules and criteria. And it's internal. not external. We like external rules. We like them because I can either do them or I don't do them. But internal rules are motivations of my heart. They're a little bit harder to evaluate, and it's a little bit harder. That's why earlier on, many churches, some of them probably still do, they said, well, you can't dance, you can't play cards, you can't do this, you can't do that. And hey, that makes it easier to evaluate my Christian life if so I can go down a checklist and say, you did this, you didn't do this, you did this, you didn't do that. Sorry, you can't teach the class. That's the easy way of doing it, but it's now what's inside my heart that is what we are looking at in the Sermon on the Mount. Scribes and the Pharisees had no way of getting into heaven. Said, you got to do better than this, better than they are doing. Love your enemies. It's a standard to a whole new level. Sermon on the Mount is not a system of laws for the Christian. Rather, it's a reflection of the heart of God living on earth. We are to be a reflection of the heart of God living on earth. Next observation, the recurring theme of the Sermon on the Mount is forgiveness. To forgive is to give mercy instead of judgment. To give kindness instead of retaliation. To give pardon instead of punishment. Forgiveness is a basic component of the Sermon on the Mount. And probably one of the most freeing expressions of God's love that we can do is to forgive. And forgive is, we kind of simplify it sometimes to think, well, if someone has something against me, I'm to forgive them. But here it talks about to free is to give mercy instead of judgment, to give kindness instead of retaliation, and to give pardon instead of punishment. Forgiveness kind of is along the line of love covers a multitude of sins. You know, a lot of things that we do may not be just exactly someone having an ought against me, but maybe something that I don't like in the life of a given person, or I don't know if I dare say this or not, maybe even a certain political stance that I don't agree with. Can I forgive someone for that? That's what we're talking about here. Exactly. A lot of things. We're to walk in freedom and forgiveness. And the Sermon on the Mount deals a lot with that. As I read the Sermon on the Mount, the recurring theme is forgiveness. It talks about merciful, turning the other cheek, going a second mile, giving a cloak to someone who doesn't have any, loving our enemies, and forgiving what's left over. I mean, we don't have a justification for any hard feelings against anyone after reading that list. It's just not there. And yet, you know, we can get together and say, oh, such and such, or I don't like this, or I don't like that, or whatever. Hey, merciful, other cheek, second mile, giving them cloak, loving our enemies, and on down the line. Matthew 5:44, I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. What else is there? You know, how can we have hard feelings toward anyone with this kind of admonition coming from Jesus? Another observation, the Sermon on the Mount is about being Christ-like in an American dream world. I don't know if you've seen this bumper sticker or not, but I have, and I don't like it because I'm afraid it's probably got truth to it. I have no problem with Christ. It's Christians that I can't stand. Have you ever seen that bumper sticker? I've seen that bumper sticker or something that's very much like that, and whenever I see that, I cringe. You know? I cringe because I know that somewhere those people have a disconnect between the life of Christ and the life of Christians, probably because of the way they were treated at some point in time by Christians, or their perceptions. If you read that book on Christian, you find out that there are a lot of wrong, well, I don't know if wrong or not, but a lot of condemnation of Christians for being judgmental and a lot of these kinds of things. And so that's probably where this statement came from. But I, you know, we should say, well, I'd like to get out of my car and go up there and apologize to that person for anything that we might have done that caused that position. But I'm not brave enough to do that anyway. So, but anyway, it bothers me. That kind of statement bothers me. Because we are told to be Christ-like in an American dream world, and that's what we live in. A world that wants to give, wants us to get as much as we can. And we are supposed to be modeling and being Christ-like. That emphasizes that American dream, not being a part of it in the sense that we just grab on to everything that's a part of that dream. It's what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. Again, salvation is not a ticket. It's a road where Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. I kind of thought of it, you know, they have these toll booths on roads where you go in, you pay your nickel, and you grab a ticket, and you're on your way. And that's kind of the way we see our Christian life sometimes, is that I'm going along this road, and I stop at the toll booth, and there is Christ, and he hands me this ticket, and then I merrily go on my way. And you know, now I'm ready for heaven. Now I can get me to the next toll booth, so to speak. But I think the Christian walk is more like I come to a junction in the road, and I can either take this junction that leads me into eternity lost, or I can take this junction and that will lead me on to the path of Christ. And if I want to be a Christian, that's the path that I want to take. But it means doing what we are told in the Sermon on the Mount and the other writings of Jesus, is that it's not just a ticket, but it's a lifestyle. When I make that decision to serve Christ, it doesn't, I better not say that, it means that I change my life and my behaviors and everything that I do. And if people did that, if Christians did that, we wouldn't have that paragraph I read at the beginning where there's no difference between the behaviors of Christians and non-Christians, because the Christians are taking a different road. They're on a different lifestyle. They don't do the things that God would not want them to do. And my final observation is that the Sermon on the Mount intimately connects the golden rule with the narrow gate. I mean intimately. It ties the two together. Pastor Tom gave an excellent message last week entitled Come and Go Christianity, where he connected the golden rule with the narrow gate. And, you know, the golden rule is in Matthew 7:12. In everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. And then the next verse, enter the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. I mean, they're a verse apart. The golden rule and the narrow gate. And in Christianity in general, you kind of have this branch of Christianity that wants to emphasize the golden rule. We kind of call it the social gospel. There's a whole group of churches that they believe that the way to heaven is to go out and serve others, meet needs, feed the poor, and you have different hospitals that have, you know, Catholic names on them, and you have different service agencies that do that, and that's good. That's the golden rule, doing unto others. But then you have a branch of Christianity that believes that the gate is narrow, and you accept Christ, and you do everything you can, and if you're lucky, you might make it. And that's more the evangelical approach. It's a separation. And now I think in our churches we're beginning to see a reemergence of the connection between the golden rule and the narrow gate, to where people are realizing, just like you take this branch in the road, doesn't mean you're automatically a Christian and you are on your way to heaven and you just go your merry way. But when I accept Christ, there's a whole list, a whole set of new instructions that involve everything that we've talked about in the Sermon on the Mount and even more. I just read a book again for about the third time, entitled In His Steps. Have some of you familiar? It's actually the ninth most popular selling book even to this day. It was written in 1897. There's a movie out on it, In His Steps, and it's the book about a pastor who has a, and you can get it on your Kindle for a dollar, so, hey, there's, you know, it's been around so long that it's not, no one's trying to make a min off from it anymore. But anyway, about this pastor who has this person come to his door on a Friday night when he's preparing his message, and the person has a need about finding a job because he lost his job, and the pastor kind of brushes him off. And then on Sunday morning, this same person comes to his church, fancy church, and afterwards he comes up and turns around and asks the congregation about, what would Jesus do in this situation where I don't have a job and I've been to this person and this and that. And then he ends up keeling over in the front of the church, and he's taken to the pastor's home, and he dies. And then the next Sunday, the pastor is so touched that he preaches a sermon without notes for the first time, but just gets up there and shares his heart. What God told him was basically, you know, he had to evaluate, what would Jesus do? And he had a very kind of upper-class church where he had the publisher of the newspaper and the owner of a retail store and the superintendent of a railroad, some railroad people and a bunch of other good music and this type of thing. And so he says, I want to challenge everybody that if you want to do nothing but what Jesus would do for a year, I want you to meet over here in this room after the service, and we're going to talk about it. And there are about 50 of them that show up. And what they committed themselves to do is always ask the question of what would Jesus do before making any kinds of decisions in their life. And the book is about the dramatic and radical changes that went on in the life of the newspaper publisher, in the life of this, how this railroad superintendent treated his employees, in the life of this retail outlet person, and a number of others that the book goes into. And later on, it spreads to churches in Chicago and other areas. But it's a fascinating story of the changes that can take place. And I don't know, some of you probably remember in the 90s we had this WWJD where you could get the bracelets, and that was probably about the time the movie came out, I suspect. But the notion of what would Jesus do? And that's not always an easy question to answer, as they found out in that book. But it meant a dramatic change in their lifestyle. Okay, in conclusion, I'd like for us to think a little bit about the last verses of the Sermon on the Mount. And I don't think we tie them together. As a child, I'm sure you heard, well, an even older child, you've heard about you know, we have the song and the flannel graph things about building your house on the rock and building your house on the sand. And if you build it on the rock, you're going to be standing firm. And if you build it on the sand, you're going to get everything washed away. And therefore, you want to do the right thing and accept the Lord type of story. I wouldn't make a good Sunday school teacher. So, but anyway, the last few verses of the Sermon on the Mount deal with the golden rule, the narrow gate, you'll know them by their fruits, and the house on the rock or on the sand. And as I looked at that, I thought, this is kind of the way he is summing up the Sermon on the Mount. The golden rule. And in that last few verses, just before the house on the sand and the house on the rock, he talks about, you know, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father. Many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did not we prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons? In your name perform many miracles? Then I'll tell them plainly, I never knew you, away from me. And then he goes immediately into the story of the one who builds on the rock is the one who hears these words that I have just told you and does them. And the one who doesn't do them is like the man who built his house on the sand. There's a connection there, and I'm afraid it's a challenging connection that really ought to motivate us to pay more attention to the Sermon on the Mount, to pay more attention to the other writings of Jesus, because there are none of them in there that contradict the Sermon on the Mount. Anywhere you read, you can look all you want. None of them will contradict the Sermon on the Mount. I have I don't have a suspicion. I'm pretty sure that the house on the sand and the house on the rock and the distinction between the two has to do with, are you doing what I said that you need to do? Are we doing the Sermon on the Mount? Because he just says you can perform miracles and drive out demons and prophesy, all good stuff. All stuff that I wish I could do better and more of. But, you know, he doesn't place that on as high a level as he does doing the things that he talks about in the Sermon on the Mount. I'd like to close with an example. When we go hunting out in to the east somewhere, I tell you exactly, but it wouldn't make any difference. But anyway, this last year we went hunting up there, and we'd go up, you know, we have four-wheelers, and we'd go up to go hunting. And on this one road we came to, there was a deep washout. I mean, it was significant. It took away half the road, and it was steep. It was not something that if you just drove into, you would, you know, run up the other side of the ditch, and maybe it was 150 to 200 feet to the bottom and steep. Now, I had a choice. I could either see how close to the edge I wanted to drive my four-wheeler, or I could see how far from the edge I wanted to drive so that I wouldn't fall off and destroy myself. And those who were following, I would stop or slow down and say, hey, you know, look at that. Because I didn't want anyone else falling into that cavern as well. And I think that's kind of the way our Christian life ought to be. We talked at the beginning about being like the world and doing the same things that the world does. And if you kind of treat that cliff, that drop-off, that slough-off as being the things of the world that you don't want to be a part of, you can either try to walk as close as possible and then hope you don't slide in, or you can make sure that you are as far away from it as possible. And I didn't stop going. I mean, we continued to use that road. We continued to go out into the world, and we continued to use it. We just made sure that we didn't get so close to the edge that we dropped off. And I think that's what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. It's knowing Jesus, doing everything, going out into the world, loving our neighbors, forgiving them, and that in that kind of activity is staying away from the cliff, and it won't allow you to fall off. But we're still to go out. We've had a mentality for so long that Christians ought to separate themselves from the world. No, we continue to go up and down the road. We continue to do it. We just move ourselves away by reading the Word of God and staying in the Word of God. We move ourselves away from the cliff that we could drop off if we got too close. And I think the Lord is challenging us to do that, to get out there, just make and do the things that Jesus has told us to do. Let's just make sure that we don't get close to the edge where we will fall off. So, you're on your way. If you don't know the Lord, if you haven't taken that split path and said, okay, I want to follow the Lord and do what He says, then there'll be some people up here that would be more than happy to share the way of the Lord with you. If you need healing, you know, just because He says that doing miracles isn't as good as doing what's in the Sermon on the Mount doesn't mean He doesn't want to heal. He wants to heal, and He wants to do miracles. He wants to do all of that. And there'll be those up here. And if you just want to come up and recommit your life to the Lord and determine that you want to follow in His steps, then I'm sure He would appreciate that too. With that, you're dismissed. Lord bless you.